Okay. Hello, friends. Took a little bit of doing there to get in order, and I trust now that we can go on. We're on program number 79. And this is the externalization of the hierarchy that we're dealing with. We've just had a very inspiring closing statement by the Tibetan. He knows that one must inspire. The Son of God is on his way, and he cometh not alone. His advance guard is already here, and the plan which they must follow is already made and clear. Let recognition be the aim. Now that is something that could be memorized to produce enthusiasm within oneself and others. It's kind of a charge, a release of energy to inspire. So we go on. The preparation for the reappearance of the Christ. We're on page 612. And we're in the year 1947. I think the Tibetan had already discontinued his work with the New Seed Group for various reasons. But he did stay in touch with them. He just saw, in terms of the timing, that it was not going to work out. And he only had a little time remaining. Alice Bailey died in December of 1949, about 2.5 years after this was written. I have much to say here as a sequence to my previous communication to you. And here I am speaking to all aspirants and disciples. The opportunity is so great at this time that I seek to face you with your choices, leaving you free to make up your own minds. What you decide will, however, affect definitely the remainder of your life activity. Herein lies your challenge. Herein lies your challenge. All right, so this is a continuation. Actually, the previous essay is found pretty much in the Reappearance of the Christ book. So let's see if this one is as well. We will be able to tell before long. What I have to say here is of a relatively simple nature, so simple that it may seem to you as in the nature of an anticlimax. Yet, simple as the problem may be, it is most difficult to solve. Your reaction to what I have to say will depend upon the nature of your sense of values and not upon any capacity for abstruse reasoning. The average human aspirant and the intelligent human being are apt to emphasize the present complexity of human affairs and events. These, they believe, are engulfing men in every land. They thus provide for themselves an answerable alibi, meaning an excuse of why they are for doing less than otherwise they might. So something simple, but difficult to solve. That's what he's going to face us with here. The emphasis of what I have to say is related to the message which I recently sent out, re the return of the Christ. That message carried its own challenge, and the questions which it aroused in every sincere human heart are, how can I personally meet this challenge? What can I specifically do? What are the steps which I and every aspirant should take? Well, it's coming down to action, isn't it? And I suppose we still ask ourselves these questions because we have not yet perhaps solved the question of how we might serve best and most efficiently in relation to the big project. We have to acquaint people with what is happening and do it in a reasonable manner. So, let's see. These questions mean one thing to one person and another thing to another. Some of the replies will emerge as you read what I have to say. I am writing here for people who are disciples of the Christ, but my words can convey meaning to all sincere thinkers and Christian believers. Okay, so really after the war, you know, the opportunity was tremendous and he wants people to make the most of it, which means he has to face us with our own evaluation of what he has to say, which will test our sense of values and be determining for the rest of the particular incarnation. The complexities and difficulties of this post-war period are very great. The closer an aspirant is to the source of spiritual light and power, the more difficult is his problem, and at the same time, the clearer will be the understanding, his understanding of the facts. Looking away from the detail of the foreground, whichever assumes undue proportions, and divorcing oneself from these details as they deluge one's daily life with perplexities and anxieties, the problem is relatively simple and twofold in nature. All right, well, we're, you know, dealing with a period approximately 73 years ago. And things did not relent, the outward fighting ceased, and how to rebuild the world, how to restore, how to enlighten, how to reconstruct, these things came into prominence. Okay. So the first, twofold in nature. Now, of course, our task is to apply what DK has said to our present dilemmas and the rising again of a crude response and contrary response to spiritual possibilities now rising in different places in the world. First of all, the outer physical war is only just over. Well, let's say 2 years, right? 2 years is a short time since the firing ceased, and no country has as yet recovered from its dire effects. There is no true intercourse between nations and no true understanding. Today, the United States permits the raising of funds in order to arm the Zionists against Great Britain, an ally and a friendly power. It is authorizing propaganda against Russia, also an allied and friendly power. There is no true effort anywhere carried on with fixed determination and right compromise to bring to an end those economic conditions which are the major cause of war and which are responsible for the breeding hatred among the nations. So, you know, we have a situation which steps which should have been taken are not being taken, and in which contrary action, contrary to alliance, such steps are being taken. It does seem, you know, that the United States is a bit of a culprit here in all of its enthusiastic, youthful hubris, its pride, its sense that it was responsible for the winning of the war, and not giving credit where credit is due, especially to Russia, whose sacrifice was tremendous. So there is no real understanding going on. 2 years afterwards, it's as if people were not learning the lesson they should have been learning. And secondly, and of still more importance from the angle of spiritual values, though less easily perceived, the forces of evil are still active. They may have been driven back, but they are still powerful. They are still subtly working and are still striving for a firmer foothold. They are still cleverly feeding world anxiety and world insecurity in order to create another point of world tension. Well, you know, you always have to be wary of the second blow. Well, in a way, World War II was the second blow when compared to World War I, and what he's talking about now is the possible second blow in relation to the entire Great War. The forces of evil are still active, and they are active today. They create fear, and they create a barrier between man and his spiritual nature. They promote the values of self-indulgence. And of course, the United States is particularly susceptible with its Jupiter in Cancer, which seeks the fulfillment of the personality nature. Of course, it has higher meanings, but I think it's in the second house of the U.S. chart when Gemini is considered to be rising. But there's a dispute in the chart of the United States, or relative to the chart of the United States. Is it Gemini rising or is it Sagittarius rising? And people sort of fight over that, you know. So these are two factors. The forces of evil still being active and no true communications, interplay between nations, and no true understanding and no real recovery. I mean, the forces of reconstruction had still to operate. So, you know, it does seem as if the forces of darkness seized upon the Zionistic situation and created a certain sense of enthusiastic pride in the Jews for the, as they contemplated the regaining of their ancient land and their ancient civilization. And as DK said, they had no idea how welcoming other countries would be for them. But the economic conditions were not being solved either. To bring to an end the economic conditions, I think when we're talking about that, I'll attempt to use the color green. You know, I'm not exactly consistent here, but at least it points in the direction of the unsolved issue of sharing. And I guess even right now, the people most affected by the forces of evil are those least able to recognize that they are so affected. Until these two sources of world tension are recognized and correctly handled, the life of the aspirant and still more of the disciple is exceedingly hard. You may retort, and truly, that the life of all who suffered through the war, the fate of the starving people who are still taking the brunt of the attack in Europe, the inhabitants of Great Britain, Italy, China, Poland, and the Balkans, plus Germany and Japan, who are responsible for the difficulty, and all who are engulfed in the result of Germany's attack upon the world, is hard beyond endurance and must therefore be shared by all aspirants and disciples. And that is indeed true. Okay. He's trying to make a point here about the burden on disciples and in comparison to the burden of upon other people. So what does he say? The life of all who suffered through the war, the fate of the starving people who are still taking the brunt of the attack in Europe, the inhabitants of Great Britain, Italy, China, they were all attacked or taken over, Poland attacked, the Balkans attacked, plus Germany, the attacker, and Japan, the attacker, who came under tremendous difficulty when the counterattack came. So Germany and Japan, who are responsible for the difficulty, and all who are engulfed in the results of Germany's attack upon the world, is hard beyond endurance and must therefore be shared by all aspirants and disciples. That is indeed true. But the more advanced thinkers and workers have far more than the general fate to endure. They, if they are open, if they open their hearts and minds, participate not only in the difficulties confronting the mass of men everywhere, but they are also aware of the spiritual possibilities ahead, of the task to be completed in sealing the door where evil dwells, because I think it was the Saggioli who said that the Zionism conflicts in the late 40s left ajar the door where evil dwells. And the stupendous and unique circumstances which are faced by those who recognize and accept the imminent return of the Christ. well, they know something more, and the tension between what they do know and conditions as they are make for even more of a burden to their psyche and probably to their physical existence in the world. So there's a double weight to be endured. As the disciple confronts both the inner and outer events and possibilities, he is apt to register a sense of complete frustration. He longs to help, but he knows not what to do. His grasp of the menacing difficulties, his analysis of his resources and those and of those with whom he works, and his clarity of perception as to the forces ranged against him make him feel inclined to sit back and say, what is the use of any effort I make? Why not let the two forces of good and evil, of the Black Lodge and the spiritual hierarchy, fight it out alone? Why not permit the pressure of the evolutionary current eventually and at long last to bring cessation to the fight and the triumph of the good? Why attempt to do it now? So, you know, a kind of a fatigue and a hopelessness has set in for some. And, he knows not what to do. Inclined to sit back and say, what good can I do? But there are always stories about how one worker can make a difference. Well, these are natural reactions, says the Tibetan, when considering the present field of conflict. The conflict's still going on, driven back and submerged, but still going on, and today still going on. The prevalent greed and the international and racial antagonisms and the selfish motives which control so many national units, plus the dull apathy of the masses, and in particular, the growing suspicion and distrust between the United States and Russia, a situation in which both groups are almost equally to blame. Well, Stalin played his part, and we did not have FDR anymore. And the United States was not known for its wisdom. It was triumphant, but unwise in the aftermath of the triumph. Immature, we might say, and that immaturity still demonstrates today when it almost seems like another civil war is being fought under different circumstances in the States. So almost equally to blame, maybe he blames the United States more, I don't know. This war-generating situation is fostered behind the scenes by a highly clever and strongly anti-communistic power of the Roman Catholic Church, with its organized political plans which are growing notably in the United States. Of course, there have been some correctives that have occurred since that time. To these, the intelligent thinker adds the reactionary activity in every land, and the fight for oil which governs the policies of Russia, the United States, and Great Britain. The third ray is at play, the economic manipulation and the Catholic Church has pointed out with its third ray personality, and of course Gemini, the personality sign of the United States, has a lot of that third ray energy, even though it's only the second ray which is assigned to it. But, you know, just like any individual, there's more than one ray. I think in some cases DK just gave us the ray that is most prominent. So the strongly anti-communistic power, you know, because communism is humanism, is godless, you know. That's how it was perceived by the Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church also had its intentions to achieve worldly power, temporal power, and we certainly associate that with the third ray. To these factors must be added today the struggle, you know, it was terrible, between Hindu and Muslim for the control of India and the fight over Palestine. Well, you know, there was the partition of India, and Pakistan was created, and the Muslims moved north, and not all, and the Hindus stayed in the south. So Pakistan became, what was called Pakistan, became a Muslim refuge, and the majority religion and way of life, the Hindus stayed in what we still called India, and then the fight came over Kashmir, and that beautiful area that both claimed and wanted. So the Hindu and Muslim, you've seen horrible pictures, photographs of the result of that battle. The vultures gorging themselves on human flesh from the great slaughter. And the fight over Palestine, fomented by the Zionists and not by the Jews as a whole. A fight in which the Zionists prevented the displaced Jewish persons, only 20% of the whole, from discovering how welcome they are in many countries throughout the world. A fight which has greed, I suppose, for oil resources, has greed and not any love of Palestine behind it, and which is governed by financial interests and not by the humanitarian spirit which the Zionists claim, and which would force them to accept the offers made by Great Britain, Canada, Chile, Belgium, and many other lands, the offers for residence in those countries. But then, you know, there were so many who wanted the reassertion of a Jewish nation. Yet again, as DK says, look at the motives, because greed was there. And again, we have to look at the third ray personality of the Jewish group, even though there were so many Jews who were not involved in the fomentations of the Palestinians, and DK tells us that the Jews as a whole can play their role as part of a spiritual aristocracy of the future. Well, their experience has been very long, coming from the first or the last solar system, a major solar system. Those are the occult underpinnings. I remember telling a Jewish relative of mine about this, and I received, I think, a blank stare from an otherwise wonderful person. It just seemed like madness to him. But that's what happens when you sometimes share the perspective of the occultism prematurely. These factors, when realized by thinking men and women, produce a deep discouragement and a sense of futility and hopelessness. Well, those were the battles of the times. And we still have the continuing problem in the Middle East of Israel and Palestine, now apparently two different nations or groupings, and the irresolution of their ongoing conflict, and the unwillingness to resolve the conflict as if one could prevail over the other without disturbance and constant counterattack. So, deep discouragement and a sense of futility at that time. Instead, they should be faced with courage, with truth and understanding, as well as with the willingness to speak factually, with simplicity and with love, in the effort to expose the truth and clarify the problems which must be solved. The opposing forces of entrenched evil must be routed before he for whom all men wait, the Christ, can come. So, at that time, these forces were not yet routed, nor even today. You can see the machinations, and you can see through whom they work. So, the problem was not really dealt with. Yeah. And we have the result of it today, just an ongoing simmering, festering situation in the Middle East, with Israel, for all of its contributions, known as the Zionist entity. The Arab nations surrounding Israel do not even deign to call it a country. It's an entity. And apparently, in their eyes, it has no legitimacy. And cannot be allowed to abide. So the battle to expel Israel from lands that were conquered by the Muslim armies continues. The idea there is that if once a land has been conquered by the Muslim armies, it has to stay in the possession of the Muslims. Well, there have been so many conquests and switching of the names of nations. Yes, as DK said, you know, if every country were to revert to the hands of its original owners or inhabitants, where would it end? It's an impossibility. And we can't go back 2,000 years and say, well, once we were here and now we want to be here again. Everything changes hands, you know. I mean, we, you know, the Atlanteans maybe are no longer with us, or maybe they are in some significant measure, but the United States, DK tells us, was the center of old Atlantis. Should it be reclaimed by those who are of Atlantean consciousness or representing the Atlantean root race? So we cannot go backwards and have this nostalgia for a time when we owned, inhabited, had a civilization on this land or that land. It's just a great march backwards. And, you know, non-progressive. And gives yet another thing for people to become attached to. The knowledge that he, the Christ, is ready and anxious publicly to appear to his loved humanity only adds to the sense of general frustration, and another very vital question arises. For what period of time must we endure, struggle, and fight? We have a meditation in which these very words are brought to the attention of the meditators weekly. And remember, this is 2 years after the war that these questions are being asked. The reply comes with clarity. He will come unfailingly when a measure of peace has been restored. What that measure is up to him to discern, and it's up to us to produce. When the principle of sharing is at least in process of controlling economic affairs, controlling them, not just as a little experiment here and there, but actually emerging in control. Sharing emerges as the method by which economic affairs are governed. And when the churches, and maybe it's been added, the political groups, have begun to clean house, then he can and will come. Then the kingdom of God will be publicly recognized and will no longer be a thing of dreams and ideals. Another area where we could memorize these words and thus remind ourselves of what must happen in order for the Christ to reappear. There's so many things hierarchy is taking care of with respect to this intended reappearance, but of course humanity has its responsibility to provide those conditions which, though not complete, are at least in the right direction. Aspirants are prone to ask the question as to why the Christ does not come. In the pomp and ceremony which the churches describe to the event, and by his coming demonstrate his divine power, prove convincingly the authority of the potency of God, and thus end the cycle of agony and distress. Well, I'm sure there are many in the Christian faith, no matter what the denomination may be, that would ask that very question. And there has been a kind of uprising of the more ecstatic, enthusiastic religion's approach of late, the kind that is more likely to believe literally in what is said and meant to be interpreted symbolically in the scriptural writings. The answers to this are many. It must be remembered that the main objective of the Christ will not be to demonstrate power, but to make public the already existent kingdom of God. When he came before, he was unrecognized. And is there any guarantee that at this time it would be different? You may ask, why would he not be recognized? Because men's eyes are blinded with the tears of self-pity and not of contrition. Because, it's an evaluation of what the war has accomplished. Because the hearts of men are still corroded with the selfishness which the agony of war has not cured. Because the standards of value are the same as in the corrupt Roman Empire which saw his first appearance. Only in those days, these standards were localized and not universal, because those who could recognize him and who hope and long for his coming are not willing to make the needed sacrifices and thus ensure the success of his advent. So, here is a collection of reasons why he does not come in pomp and power. Of course, it would be completely against his nature to do so. So, all this, all the above, is an indictment of the post-war state of humanity in the world. So, these are the answers to the questions which are asked by those who would like to see a decisive display of power, which would set things straight from a religious point of view. So, unrecognized, that's a problem. Tears of self-pity, that's a problem. Corrosion, corroded with selfishness, that's a problem. You know, have we escaped this? I think I sense here some disappointment in the Tibetan as he is evaluating the situation. Standard of values ubiquitously are the same as in the corrupt Roman Empire, only not localized, but spread all over. This is why. And the unwillingness to make the needed sacrifices to promote his advent. I guess all of us have to evaluate our willingness to make sacrifices. I think we do. It is not easy to sacrifice given our present egotistical attitudes. So these are reasons why he does not return, and certainly he just cannot return in a way that would confirm the illusory notions about him, which are fostered by so many religious groups. Glamour and illusion are really problems. When you see these mega churches and you see that some of them are based upon gaining material wealth as proof that one is loved by God, and the concentration is on the use of magical power to gain material substance, you realize how far we have deviated from the loving message of the Christ. We are not rich in the energies of the kingdom of heaven. We want to be rich in worldly energies. So materialism has crept into church presentations of what spirituality is, or so they think. So a great and horrible war, and then an assessment following the war that things are not even yet as they should be. Well, we have to take this to heart. Have they improved? I think, you know, a lot of advanced souls were sent in the 60s and 70s to try to raise humanity's sense of values, but then were those who were sent in successful? Or did they too give in to a kind of a hedonistic material indulgence? Many were spiritual, but was their spirituality strong enough to sway more than those who believed as they believed? Certainly a cleavage was there. There are just so many in the United States who are not swept by the consciousness revolution, and then that extended to other countries when the influence of the sort of, you know, Berkeley, California flowering moved to different places in the world. The Chinese were experiencing, in some ways, a very destructive cultural revolution. And other places were experiencing change, but not necessarily a beneficent revolution in consciousness. So again, some gain was achieved, but not, I think, what the masters had hoped. And, you know, DK, when he starts to write again or present his books, his bridging treatises for serious study, will probably evaluate where we have gone astray, and we'll do so from the angle of a master's perspective. And we will then see things in a different way than now we do. Another factor militating against his being recognized, and one which will probably surprise you, is the fact that there are so many exceedingly good people in the world today, so many selfless workers and disciples, and so many truly saintly people, that the spiritual competition would call forth a degree of holiness on his part which would negate his appropriation of a physical body of a caliber which would enable him to manifest among men. And he could not perhaps create a Mayavarupa which would allow human interchange between himself and those he would have to speak to. He would have to demonstrate a degree of energy of a ethereal kind which would render futile his intentions. Now that's interesting. So something militating against recognition of who he really is. And it is unusual to think of this. He doesn't seem to be talking about occultists when he talks about truly saintly people, but really unselfish persons. Well, that is interesting and a difficult problem. And so he faces difficulties in establishing who he is among those for whom he comes. It is said that he comes for his own. Of course, ultimately, he comes for all of humanity, but the recognition will be given to him by his own, those who have penetrated through mistaken perceptions and can recognize who he is. But, you know, there's encouragement here because there are a lot of good people. There are a lot of people who have succeeded in adopting the approach of Christ love, which is a success. But then how does non-discriminating humanity recognize the difference between the Christ and these people? He would have to present himself in such a way that magical powers would be used to alert people to an awe-inspiring demonstration, and then they would begin to worship him rather than cooperate with him. Moria makes quite a focus on that, basically telling us that it's not the worship of the Christ that is needed, but the imitation of the Christ is needed. So the number of difficulties that he faces in reappearing appropriately and constructively are many and difficult. Anyway, it wasn't the case 2,000 years ago that there were so many of a high caliber that it might be difficult to discriminate between him and others. This was not the case 2,000 years ago. It is, however, the case today. So great is human advancement and the success of the evolutionary process. To enable him today to walk among men requires a world which will have in it enough effective workers and spiritually minded people to change the atmosphere of our planet. Then and only then, now atmosphere, I suppose this means the subtle atmosphere, the psychic atmosphere, but maybe also, you know, there's a hint there about the pollution, which interestingly has gone down so dramatically during a stay-at-home period during the coronavirus of 2020, and who knows when those of you who may use this video will reach this point. How long did it last? So effective workers and spiritually minded people have to be present to change the atmosphere of our planet, certainly the psychic atmosphere. Then and only then, the Christ can and will come. And I'm not, however, presenting you with an impossibility. So we have to be mature in realizing the difficulties that he faces. The Tibetan began some pages ago putting himself empathically in the place of the Christ and feeling with him the kind of horror involved in the engagement of the task before him, as he contemplates what it would mean really to appear and to basically save and solve, or at least guide humanity to save and to solve. Later, you know, we'll know what he did, what his techniques were, when we reach a sufficient degree of advancement to understand. Right now, we're very far from it. So it is a surprising statement by the Tibetan that the Christ might not be recognized because there are so many highly advanced saintly types that people would have a difficult time discriminating between the Christ and his level of spirituality and the others and their level of spirituality. And I don't think the Christ would allow himself or be allowed to demonstrate such constant magical potency as to be awe-inspiring and possibly induce credulity and worship and not real cooperation. Modern esotericism and the success of scientific spiritual living are now so widely recognized that the consciousness of men everywhere has been profoundly affected, even then in the late 40s. This will be increasingly so as the hope of his coming and the preparation for its spread among men. I mean, my only concern is that those who could really help him are still incredulous of the possibility because their intellect, it seems, is too strongly developed. And the gullible might believe it, but they're not in a position to help in the same way that the more advanced types would be. Anyway, the consciousness of men has been elevated. And scientific spiritual living was being demonstrated. Now, you know, shortly after the 40s and in the 50s, it all began that this a stream of Eastern teachers came west to help the flow of occultism towards the West, and it was eagerly received by thousands, maybe even millions. but just as easily dropped by those who were not steadfast in their reception and their determination to continue cultivating what was received. Anyway, there was an elevation, and that some of that elevation has remained in place. So this consciousness, the consciousness characteristic of humanity, was elevated. And it will be elevated, consistently, I suppose, as the time of his coming approaches, as we come closer to it. This will be increasingly so, says the Tibetan, as the hope of his coming and the preparation for it spread among men. The situation indicates no divine frustration, of which that of the world's disciples might be the reflection, nor does it indicate any inability to appear. Rather, it indicates the wonder of the divinity of in man and the success of the divine plan for man. Divinity, however, awaits the expression of man's free will. So this is essentially, an optimistic statement. Man has progressed in his consciousness, but must express that which his newly elevated consciousness reveals. Well, we have to put this in context. It's 73 years ago that the Tibetan is writing this, just about three quarters of a century. Have we slipped? Have we sustained? Are the numbers of those truly elevated sufficient to raise more of humanity and facilitate the coming of the Christ? We'll know more as we go. We have to try to interpret modern anxiety, disruption, conflicts in terms of the great event for which or of which they are the harbinger. That is the externalization of the hierarchy and the reappearance of the Christ, that dual theme, which are really the two parts of which are intimately related, is the main event here on our planet. And whatever happens, let us not forget to interpret those happenings, which may be often foreground affairs, in terms of the real purpose of the times. And we'll then understand why these difficult situations are being evoked to establish spiritual values in a higher way, and to clean house, and to stop the waste of energy through unnecessary conflict. See, these are all factors which concern the Christ's reappearance and what may stand in the way of it. And it's a long chapter here, really. So as the hour creeps on, oh my goodness, I begin to wonder, yeah, work in the coming decades. Well, you know, if I make a line, I'll at least fool myself into feeling better. And it will seem that more has been accomplished. We're not there yet, and it will take a fair number of programs to get there. Yeah. Another answer about the Christ coming and why he doesn't just show up and straighten everything out is that when the Christ comes forth from the place of power, so, you know, thinking about Shambhala here, bringing his disciples, the masters of the wisdom, with him, that place of love and power will be situated on earth, I mean, his headquarters, so to speak, and, you know, a lot more visible than his mountain retreat. And will be publicly recognized, the effects of that appearance and of that recognition will be terrific, calling forth an equally terrific onslaught and effort by the forces of evil, unless humanity itself has first sealed the door where evil dwells, at least to a significant extent. And this must be done by the establishing of right human relations. Well, I remember I wrote a song about this, about the forces of darkness gathering and directing an onslaught to the place chosen by the reappearing Christ as his headquarters. Is it the United Nations? Is it New York? With its second-ray soul, a city with a second-ray soul, in a country with a second-ray soul, and a planetary center with a prominent sixth ray? You know, we can only speculate about the possibilities. But an equally terrific onslaught and effort by the forces of evil. And are we equal to sealing the door where evil dwells? Because even after the terrible experience of World War II, it was left ajar. And D.K. commended his disciple Roberto Sacioli for recognizing that that door had been left ajar, and probably because of the Zionist conflict. At one point, ironic though it was, D.K. said that the very same forces behind the Zionists were the same forces behind the Germans as they became Nazis. Now that's really unexpected. Certainly unexpected in the Zionists who thought they were carrying out something very necessary, except for the consciously greedy ones. And of course, they have no monopoly on human greed. Wall Street is fed by greed, and it's artificial. All values then are monetized. How much is it worth? How much is a man worth? What's your net worth? And put in terms of the currency of the country in which that stock market is functioning. So, the Christ has to be very careful, lest that counterattack can be so powerful that it could be destabilizing for the whole project, and many people would be caught in the instability. And still another reply, we're saying, we're saying, why does the Christ not just come? We are come, show his power, establish the kingdom of God, take care of the evildoers. Why doesn't he just show up and take care of things? And DK is giving one answer after another to help with our reasoning about or in relation to this question. Because as we attempt to familiarize people with a palatable form of the spiritually esoteric teaching, we will be asked such things. And of course, it's somehow necessary to be able to respond reasonably, so that people are not driven away and do not find the whole process fanciful and essentially unattractive, something they don't want to be involved in. Which, if they were reasoned with in the proper manner, they would want to aid. Still another reply upon which I would ask you to ponder is that the Christ and the spiritual hierarchy never, no matter what the incentive may be, infringe upon the divine right of humanity to achieve freedom by fighting for freedom individually, nationally, and internationally. The Lords of Liberation, we could say, are involved in this. One of the Lords particularly connected with freedom and the planet Uranus. When true freedom covers the earth, we shall see the end of tyranny politically and religiously. Those seem to be the two areas, the first and sixth ray, of difficulty. I refer here not to modern democracy, which is at present a philosophy of wishful thinking, but to that state of the realm in which people themselves will rule. And these people will not tolerate authoritarianism in any church or totalitarianism in any political system or government, and they will not accept or permit the rule of any body of men who undertake to tell them what they must believe in order to be saved or what government they must accept. So another reply is coming regarding the caution of the Christ as he contemplates the time of his arrival. And then, of course, humanity must have insufficient numbers taken the first initiation. And that's a surprising thought, I think. So hierarchy does not infringe. It's not allowed to hit compellingly the area of the will. Men have to fight for their own freedom. And they cannot be forced to be good, forced to do the right thing. They cannot. According to the law of freedom on Sirius. Now, the Black Lodge is limited by no such restraints or self-constraints. They will overpower the will and make slaves of those they overpower. The enslavement of humanity is their goal, and sometimes in these dystopian novels or movies, you know, you see that enslavement imagined. They may not infringe. They may not infringe. Sometimes when dealing with a great Mahatma like Maurya, you think, well, anything he says, one must do, but still, he is going to respect this great law of freedom, and basically, although he may expect people to perform what he commands, he would expect them to do so willingly and not out of the force of compulsion. So it's freedom we're talking about here. And notice how authoritarianism is the parallel to totalitarianism. The authoritarianism of the church is the parallel to the totalitarianism of governments. Now, we see a lot these days of the reemergence of egotistical authoritarianism. And maybe, well, I think there are some countries that hide totalitarianism as well. They've never really outgrown it, even though they're more sophisticated in practicing it. So people just won't accept being told what they must think, what they must do. And this is part of the rebellious nature of Aquarius, you know. Maybe under Capricorn, there's more regimentation, but under Aquarius, with its essentially Uranus rulership, there will be rebellion against being told how one is to manage one's own individuality. It's, of course, better to have the willing assent of the people than to put them in a box and say, this you must do. So they will not permit this. The people themselves eventually will not permit this, even though there are less developed people in many countries who long to be relieved of individual responsibility by having an authoritarian to whom they are devoted tell them what to do. And DK says, I say not that these desirable objectives must be accomplished facts on earth before the Christ comes. I do say that this attitude to religion and politics must be generally accepted as necessary to all men, and that steps must have been successfully taken in the direction of right human relations. So we don't want to go too far, thinking that Christ will not come unless a perfection in these matters is first achieved. What would be the point? No, it's a different truth here. Because the Christ will help us bring about the perfection of the freedom that we begin ourselves to assert. Yeah. And let me make this also part of the red letters. So a period of freedom is coming. You know, from Sirius comes the law of freedom, comes the intermediate law of karma, and comes some kind of deep spiritual sensitivity. And these desirable qualities are mediated through the three synthesizing planets, which, along with a probable planet Isis way out there, maybe taking 360 years to go around the sun rather than 360 or so days. So along with that planet that is expected and speculated upon by mathematically visionary astrologers, those Sirian qualities reach us. Freedom through Uranus, sensitivity through Neptune, and karma through Saturn. And Isis, you know, if it exists, and it appears in the mind of many that it does, Isis will be a synthesizing factor and involved with the fifth initiation. There's a mystery there about Sirius A and Sirius B and the fifth initiation under Isis, which could be Sirius and also the planet, and the fourth initiation, which is more obscured and in darkness and involves Sirius B. I don't know if it involves a different planet. So it's not perfection, but it's motive that the Christ seems to expect of humanity, and a degree of accomplishment as the result of which his reappearance could be successful in terms of what humanity needs. That, of course, is the reason for the whole thing. His reappearance must be successful in terms of the initiation and elevation of humanity, and thus, in a way, the salvation of the whole planetary project. These are the things which the new group of world servers, the disciples, the aspirants, and the men of goodwill everywhere must believe and teach. in preparation for his coming. They will answer certain questions. I mean, you know, basically we have a great misconception of what it means to be spiritually developed. There is a certain sanctified normality to it, to high spiritual development, about which the Tibetan speaks, and nothing hysterical or absurd or freakish about it. So we need to render our mind a more natural instrument rather than an instrument which distorts reality. Some occultists or students of occultism, in relation to the groups they sponsor, perpetuate glamours and great distortions. They have the twisted, exaggerated mind that never quite frees itself from the emotions. They're still the victims of kama manas. Maybe they'll help some, at least, rise out of a profound materialism, but there reaches an end to their usefulness, and their obstructive nature becomes more evident. So there is therefore nothing to offset the sense of frustration, which is undeniably present and based on factual conditions, but the acceptance and the development of a state of mind which will be founded on a belief in the veracity of the historical records which bear witness to the many advents at crucial times in human affairs and to many world saviors of whom the Christ was the greatest. Is he making the Christ even greater than the Buddha? Well, maybe, you know, the Christ was closer to earth humanity than the Buddha could be, being a product maybe not only of the moon chain, but maybe also of the previous solar system, previous major solar system. We're told that the seeds of that solar system ripened in him, which may be an indication that he was individualized in that system, maybe, and developed further on the moon chain until he could develop no more, and then continued his development in our chain in this second major solar system. The right and constructive attitude must also be based on an innate recognition of the existence of the Christ and of his presence with us at all times. So, all of this is about overcoming frustration. History and the testimony of spiritual occultism. You know, there are psychological diseases. Maybe despair is one of those, but as Christ through Jesus was wont to say, your faith hath made you whole. Healing is making a wholeness out of divided, warring organs, energies, factors, and faith brings them all together. So the frustration can be offset by the acceptance and the development of the state of mind, believing. In the historical record of the many advents of sons of God at times when revelation was necessary, and to the many world saviors. This will help offset. Now, do you find yourself frustrated for the reasons that DK has spoken, or are you borne along by optimism and enthusiasm and faith in what has been presented? Okay. So the right and constructive attitude must also be based on the idea that the Christ really has been with us all the days, even unto the end of the age, which tells us to have confidence in him, because he will not abandon humanity. And even when the time is right and he must leave, he will make sure there is a proper succession, so that humanity can continue to develop on this planet. So we're looking at how to develop. How to develop a right and constructive attitude in the face of frustration. That's what this is, this section is all about. Well, now so many things are happening to produce enthusiasm. We're very close to the release of the new teaching and to decisions made in the great conclave of 2025, which will begin a new phase in the externalization, something far more tangible. So the Christ is present, and we study the historical record and interpret it in the way that occultism suggests, which is a deeper type of interpretation than is usually advanced by the non-believer. There's much about us that is the believer, but hopefully we base our belief on the kind of rationality which the Tibetan has presented and with which he teaches. And then this right and constructive attitude, you know, this is what we're talking about here. How do we get beyond this inevitable questioning of why not just sit back and let it happen? And not get involved at this time. And that time, 75 years ago, 73 years ago, it's pretty much like this time. Why not sit back and let the Tibetan come forward with new teaching? Why not let the conclave, attended by those who are far our superiors, take place and all will be well? Why do more? And the same kind of question has to be answered. So this right and constructive attitude, it must be grounded in the knowledge that the war with all its unspeakable horrors, the cruelties, and its cataclysmic disasters, was but the broom of the Father of all, sweeping away obstructions in the path of his returning Son. Well, as you know, people who were through the war, many of them never recovered in that particular incarnation from the horrors they experienced. They were no longer psychologically normal, we might say. And DK tells us here that, yes, we have to reinterpret what the war really was. Well, it's one thing if you may have maintained your psychological normality, and another if you have been so abused that you have become psychologically abnormal. I think there was a film in the 1960s called The Pawnbroker. Rod Steiger. And it was about a man who had lost everything. He was a Jewish man. He had lost everything in the horrors of the war, and he was no longer normal. No longer. And, you know, many people in the never again attitude became so hardened that they were no longer psychologically normal. They couldn't rise above it. But this kind of attitude about the deeper shambolic meaning of the war could help those who believe and who reason on the matter to see it from a more elevated perspective, and maybe in some way, despite the horrors, be grateful. You know, none of us would be anything but young children or just born during the war. So, you know, it's not the same for us, but some may have been through the horrors and then were reborn rapidly, and that is possible. And what did we carry into our incarnation as a result of those horrific experiences? It would have been well nigh impossible to prepare for the coming, this second coming, in the face of pre-war conditions. All right. Is it the Great War? Somewhere he talks about World War I in the same way, that if the conditions in Europe and elsewhere had remained as they were, there would be no progress for humanity. And here the second coming, the coming of the Son of God, as he is known, the returning Son, or one who demonstrates the Son aspect, could not have taken place without the broom of the Father sweeping clear the way of the returning Son. It sounds innocuous, but it was unspeakable for many. Upon these facts, the new group of world servers must today take their stand. They must recognize the obstructing factors, but must also refuse to be frustrated by them. They must be aware of the hindrances, many of them financial and based on material greed, and then employ such skill in action, You know, there are seventh ray first degree initiates who are emerging, who are supposed to help to straighten out the financial imbalance in the world. They must refuse to be frustrated by them. They must be aware of the hindrances, many of them financial, based on greed, and then employ such skill in action and such business acumen that these hindrances may be or will be overcome. They must walk clear-eyed through the world of difficulties and holding his, the Christ's, five-pointed star before them, pass unscathed and successful through the midst of all frustrating factors. So here is the Tibetan again giving us an exhortation, a charge towards better functioning and the overcoming of immediate obstacles, you know, filling us with the energy to do that. And it applies now as it applied then. Well, there's more. You know, concerning the obstacles, the inertia, the lack of money and all that, and we'll get into it. But I think, you know, that since we have quite a bit to go, it looks like there's quite a bit. So I think, you know, I'll let it be. We're on page 914 here, and if we go back to where we were letting off, you know, these are computer pages. We're on page 901. So 14 pages, there's no way that that can be done except through a series of programs. But then in terms of the book, we're on page 619. So I think I'll call it now. A day, as the midnight hour has occurred. Yeah, we're on page 619. And I'll go back to where this all started. So 612 to 619. And our day is still the 13th/14th of June. Year is 2020, and it's about 1 hour and maybe 40 minutes, something like that. All right. So now we get into the 80s in terms of our programming. This one having been number 79. I guess what we must do, so this is 79. And basically 140, roughly. The other program I thought was 240, but it's more like 3, the one that preceded this. And the end here was 612 to 619. And we'll begin with number 80, which we say will be approximately 1 hour and something, don't know yet. And page 619 to wherever it takes us. And the date will be, let us see, XX. Okay, friends, so it is my hope that all went satisfactorily with this recording. We're putting ourselves in the quasi-historical mode, and then we are looking into the future as if we were there 73 years ago, and now we are in that future and trying to see how the information that the Tibetan gave and the trends that he pointed out did develop, because we're in a better position now to see whether there has been development or whether the same conditions are prevailing. Now, to a great extent, the uncertainty, the final decision here, is still with us. We haven't made that decision. And we're right on the point in these years preceding the great conclave of 2025 and the release of the new bridging material. We're right on the point of making those fateful decisions. Somehow this book is teaching us how to serve and what to emphasize and how to inspire humanity to see through their glamours and illusions and develop a new mode of spiritual expression. And it's a very practical book. So, you know, it answers for us, well, what do I do to help? It answers in a clear way. It is a movement. No one of us is ultimately responsible for it or plays an undue role. We have certain gifts and we give what we have. And hopefully our gifts and the gifts of those of our co-workers who are working along similar lines will be adequate to the task of helping humanity prepare better for its first initiation and for the externalization of the hierarchy and the reappearance of the Christ, which will signal that the first initiation has been taken by humanity, or at least by a sufficient number to leaven the spirituality of humanity. So he's going to get into some frustrations here, some difficulties. They involve inertia and money, very practical things, and we'll see, you know, is it still the same or have there been developments which have improved things or worsened them? Okay, so friends, that's going to be it for the moment, and I'm sorry kind of for the unevenness of the duration of these programs. I either have to choose to do a particular essay or break the essay at certain points or try to confine myself to units like 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, etc., or on the half hour. I never know which I'm going to do, but we will continue with this, knowing that we have maybe another 80 pages or so to go. To the end of this book, I think it's basically correct. I've been saying it is so. Now let's see if it's correct. Yep, 701. So maybe another 80 pages or so in this part, and then we'll see if we can offer something from the beginning of the book, which I kind of passed over when I started wanting to be a bit more current. So, lots of love, many blessings. Study hard, meditate deeply, and serve in an understanding way and to the best of your capacity to do so. We'll start again tomorrow. That's my hope. Bye-bye for now.